Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry Jacobs. I am director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, which is at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Today's conversation is the last this fall. We've had a very busy year, 16 events and webinars on a whole range of topics. And I want to take just a moment to thank the folks who've made this possible, beginning with Cody Jacket, who's a program specialist. He schedules our events along with supporting our important leadership development program. Cody, are you there?
Hello.
There we go. That's Cody. He's an all-star. Thank you so much, Cody, for all that you do. Also, I want to acknowledge and thank Lee Chittenden, who wears a bunch of hats. She's the associate program director for the center. She's also the administrative director for the center's pioneering certificate and election administration program. Thank you, Lee, for all the hard work you do. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Barry.
Okay, so now I want to jump in and kind of bring you up to date about what we're going to do right now, which is have a great conversation about unionization and where we are with that. Before we begin, I just want to give you a heads up that your participation is a very important part of our conversation this afternoon. You'll see at the bottom of your screen, there's a Q&A button. Please click on that. Give us your questions. We like challenging questions. We like questions on topics that haven't been covered. Please become part of the discussion today. Also, you see right next to it is a live transcript feature. If you'd like to use that, click on that. I would like to introduce my colleague in the history department who has organized today's event and will be moderating it, William Jones. He's a history professor here at the University of Minnesota. Professor Jones, take it away.
Thank you, Larry, and thanks to all of you for joining us for today's program, The Rising Tide of Unionization, with a question mark. Our guests today are Bernie Burnham, Professor Charlotte Garden, and Kathy McGarry. Bernie Burnham is president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a position she's held since February of 2022. Prior to her role with the AFL-CIO, she served as vice president of Education Minnesota. She was an elementary school teacher for 14 years, where she was active in the labor management process in the Duluth Public Schools. Charlotte Garden joined the University of Minnesota Law School faculty in fall of 2022. She specializes in labor law, employment law, and constitutional law. Her interests include the intersection of workers' rights and the Constitution, and how law supports or undermines worker voice and power. Kathy McGarry is the Vice President of Human Resources and Labor Relations for the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and was previously the Chief Labor Relations Officer for Hennepin County, where she managed the county's relationship with 17 bargaining units representing 6,500 employees. This is a remarkable moment for organized labor. Nearly 500,000 workers went on strike this year. You've probably heard of the strike by the United Auto Workers, which recently won major changes to wages and benefits. Hollywood actors and writers also won major victories. We saw a number of less publicized strikes or threats to strikes by healthcare workers and hotel workers, a threatened strike by the Teamsters, which led to a major contract victory. And workers at Starbucks and lots of surprising smaller retail stores launched strikes. Tomorrow, the Starbucks Workers Union is planning a nationwide series of strikes and protests. This represents the largest strike wave probably since the 1980s. And coupled with remarkable political changes, it represents a potential turning point in the history of organized labor in this country. We see since 2010, we've seen a public approval of unions go from 48%, an all-time low, the first time since these records have been kept that approval of organized labor dipped below 50% in 2010. And since then, we've seen it rise to a remarkable 71% last year, close to the all-time high, which is closer to 75%. This change in popularity of organized labor, I think, is reflected in President Biden's vow to be the most pro-union president in history, and shown by his joining auto workers on picket lines, an unprecedented event for a sitting president. And yet this remarkable burst of militancy and public approval of organized labor has yet to lead to the reversal of a much broader and enduring trend in the decline of organized labor. Since the 1950s, the percentage of workers belonging to unions has plummeted from over 30% to about 10% today. In 2022, which was also a year of increased militancy and organization, the unionization rate fell by 2%. The strike victories that we've seen have been won by particularly well-established unions. The United Auto Workers, the Screen Actors Guild, the Teamsters, these are all unions that have existed since the 1930s and long before. New unions have found a much harder time. Starbucks Workers United, for example, has won union representation elections in 361 stores across the United States, and not one of them has signed a union contract. So the questions for today that we're going to consider are, how do we explain this contradiction between an unprecedented and historic rise in union militancy and tremendous support, public support for unions, with a continued decline in the power and size of organized labor? What does it say about the state and the future of organized labor? And what would it take to reverse the broader trend of union decline? Do unions have a future? We've assembled really, I can't imagine a better group of people to talk about these questions and help us grapple with them. We hope that you will add your questions to the chat, and this will be a free-flowing conversation. So I'd like to begin with President Burnham, Professor Garden, and Kathy McGarry, just by asking whether you agree with the premise of this conversation. Do you see this contradiction in the ways that I've laid it out between militancy and popularity of unions on one hand, but a continued decline that we can trace back to the 1950s? Professor Garden, would you like to begin?
Thank you. And thank you for inviting me to be on this panel. So I guess I'll say yes and no. As a lawyer, I always try to respond to yes or no questions with a yes or no. In 2022, 14.3 million people belong to unions, and that is 273,000 more than the previous year. People in the audience will probably be aware of the huge wave of organizing among grad students, media workers, nonprofit workers, in addition to Starbucks, workers in other retail stores, the Staten Island Amazon warehouse, and so on. And in 2022 and 2023, union elections have been way up compared to the last few years. At the same time, right, union density ticked down as a matter of percentage. That overall statistic hides tremendous variation between the public and private sectors. So about a third of public sector workers are unionized and only about 6% of private sector workers. It also hides huge geographic differences. So in New York, about a fifth of workers are unionized and less than 2% in South Carolina. Minnesota's at about 15%. You know, numbers, obviously not the whole story. There is, you know, there are the strikes that Professor Jones mentioned, the public approval, right, the 60-year high. I think it's also interesting that public approval of unions has diverged from public approval of corporations. It used to be more common for the two numbers to vary together, as I assume people sort of thought about the institutions that are largely responsible for the functioning of the economy together, right? And now see them separately. You know, I also think it's important to think about unions in the kind of political process. So as a kind of major mobilizing role in electoral politics, also mobilizing for specific improvements in state and local labor and employment laws, right? So, you know, the fight for 15, right? Of course, the, you know, probably most prominent recent example. So, you know, to me, you know, the numbers of unionized workers undoubtedly extremely important. And I'm glad we're talking about that today. But also, I think just, you know, part of the picture when we think about the strength of labor.
Thank you. Kathy McGarry, would you like to address this? And, you know, you're coming from the point of view of somebody in human relations, and I wonder how that affects your view of these questions.
Sure, absolutely. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me. I'll start by saying, you know, I'm currently the VP of Human Resources and Labor for the MAC, the Airport Commission. I'm here, though, today as really somebody who's just worked on the management side in both public and private sector. So I'm a proud alumni of University of Minnesota, which is how I was found. So most of these opinions are going to be my observations across my whole career, not attributable to MAC, where I currently work. But I would have to echo some of what the professor said, particularly because I am now in the public sector. Yeah, it's been 10 years since I worked on the private sector side. The public sector is heavily unionized. And so it's a little hard for me to provide any personal, you know, real recent observations because the unions are here. There's not a lot of organizing going on. Most of the organizing's been done. So my observations would be what I read in the paper, and just I would echo the professor's comment. I think the unions remain very powerful politically. I do see the failure of organizing to convert into first contracts sometimes. So that I think there's a lot more noise, a lot more publicity, but I'm not sure that the successes are happening in other sectors. Certainly there were some big successes, as you said, in the big, you know, entertainment, UAW, those big established unions. I don't know if those successes will translate. I feel like I've seen more things not translate into any real success.
President Burnham, would you like to address that opening question?
Sure. I think, you know, I agree with both Charlotte and Kathy on a number of points. I think there are other reasons. You know, we've seen lots of organizing and we've seen lots of strikes, as you all mentioned. Their work has changed, right? I mean, when you think of like in retail, there are a lot of places that you self-check out. So there are less workers in these stores. And so that counts for some of the decrease in numbers of workers that are actually able to join a union. When we think of the smaller unions who are organizing and are winning unions in their stores, they're not going the traditional route, you know, the old school route of joining these bigger bodies that are the bigger unions like UAW, SEIU, Unite Here, and all the larger bodies. So they want something different, and they should want something different. They're new and they're young and they want their own voice and they want to do it their way. And so, you know, in the labor world, we want to support them and we're trying to figure out how we help them get to that contract. I think we have to think about who holds the wealth in this country, because they want to, the people that have the wealth want to hang on to it. And so they're not as likely to really agree with what labor used to look like, right? They're not going to bend as easily to the old ways of how we used to organize and those kind of things. So there's a number of reasons. I can tell you here on the ground, in Minnesota, we're working with people all the time. And we constantly, not only here, but I'm also working with the national AFL-CIO, and there are always new people coming into the movement. It's a matter of what does that look like and what are they looking for? Because as I said, they don't want to go the traditional route. They're young. They have their own thoughts about the way things should look like. And you know what? Good for them. That's the way we all expect our younger folks to do, right? We prepare them to find their voice, do things the way they want to. And so there's a shift in the movement in that regard too. So those are some of the reasons I think there's a difference in the way it looks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, sort of picking, some of this has been touched on, but sort of let's try to focus a little bit on what are the reasons? Why do we see this increased militancy and sort of activism by unions? And the how do you explain this? I mean, I think the change in public opinion is really striking. And wonder, what do you attribute that to? President Burnham, you want to begin with that?
You know, I just go back to a lot of the conversation we heard coming out of the pandemic, that people realized there were different ways to live, right? They didn't have to work so hard. A lot of us got to stay home and work. Obviously, people on the front lines were still out and doing their jobs. And so they were the ones who were, I would say, in maybe most danger of, you know, getting sick and those kind of things. But people who worked in areas that were shut down, for instance, you know, the restaurant and all those industries, they all got shut down. So all of a sudden they realized, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, they got some paychecks because there was government assistance that helped helped them get through. And all of a sudden they thought, well, gee, I'm not sore. I'm not tired. I'm getting to spend time with family. I can make different choices about what this looks like for me. And so we heard all those stories, right, coming out of the pandemic and during the pandemic about people saying, oh, I don't have to work that, you know, and kill myself every week to make a buck or two to kind of get my family the things they want. So it was a change in mindset about what people were looking for.
Yeah. Kathy McGarry, do you have other thoughts on this question?
First of all, I saw that my sound is muffled. Is it better if I sit a little closer?
It is.
Okay. Otherwise, I can try some other speakers. I don't see anything much different than what was mentioned. I think the activism in general that started with Occupy became Fight for 15 and then bled into the pandemic. It triggered different feelings and different tactics, some of which were more successful than maybe the old tactics had been. And I just think people are not sitting back anymore, of all ages, young people in particular, but even people of all ages. You know, when you think about the Me Too movement, that wasn't just young people. It just that desire to speak up it has been amplified, I think, for everybody on all political parts of the spectrum. And there's still a subset of people who don't view their own voice as enough for a variety of economic reasons. People want that collective voice. So I think there are a lot of reasons, most of which have been said, but it is a different time. At all levels, I think, and I appreciate the comments that there's challenges within the movement. I see that from the management side as I try to work with people across the table. I see them struggle with the different desires within their group, and that was always the case, but it's much more pronounced now, I think.
So a broader sort of upburst of protest and sort of political engagement. Yeah, Professor Garden, do you have anything to add? Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with, you know, everything that both of my co-panelists have said so far. You know, I would also mention the economy in two ways. First, the, you know, low unemployment right now, people are realizing they have a little bit more power and that they can demand, you know, higher wages and get them. Also, the kind of like austerity of the, you know, beginning with the recession, right, like, through the pandemic. I mean, if you think about like Red for Ed, for example, I think part of the reason that was so successful, right, is the kind of like bargaining for the common good aspect of it, right? The idea that you know, teachers using textbooks from like the Bush administration, right, that were missing their covers. And they're saying, you know, our working conditions or your children's learning conditions. And that is a very compelling message, right? That was, you know, it's like deeply unfortunate that teachers had to fight for updated textbooks. But that really, I think, was a moment that brought people from, you know, many different political perspectives together to say like, oh, there is something like deeply wrong with some of these working conditions. And that I think is, you know, in addition to, you know, all, like other social movements, right, the pandemic, the racial justice movement is an important part of what has been going on.
Thanks. Yeah, so there's a question in the from the audience about whether it even is, does represent a contradiction. If we look at, you know, there may be increased interest in unions, but if people can't actually form unions, then, you know, that interest may not be reflected in an actual growth of unions. I wonder, just asking, and Professor Garden, I'll ask you to begin, but I'd like each of you to just talk about what are some of the barriers to union growth. Why haven't we seen? I mean, I think one statistic is, you know, if we have 70% of the public in favor of unions, but only 10% of the workforce belongs to unions. How do we explain that difference? And it's probably not a factor of, you know, people making free choices about what they want to do. So I wondered if you could sort of explain what are some of the barriers to people forming unions and joining unions.
So, you know, I think I don't think law is the only answer, but, you know, because I'm at a law school, I'm going to give an answer that focuses on law. You know, so I think that there are many ways in which the National Labor Relations Act has sort of not kept up with modern conditions. And to mention maybe just one, it has just like shockingly weak remedies. So if there is a union campaign in a private sector workplace, it is, you know, effective for an employer to simply fire a union supporter, and that is illegal. But it takes an extremely long time to get through the sort of reinstatement process, get back pay, et cetera. And in the interim, it has this sort of, you know, interim effect on other workers, right? If I stick my neck out, I could be next. Employers don't have to violate the law to be able to tell workers that, you know, to sort of tell workers things like, you know, there are, you know, the kind of like bargaining from scratch message, right? The sort of like, this will be futile. Futility messages can, you know, sort of can violate the law, but again, it's like very difficult to actually enforce the law in a timely fashion. So, you know, to me, it is that labor law starts out with a kind of lopsided set of tools that are available to employers versus to unions, right? Just think about like access, right? An employer can, if it wants to, hold a captive audience meeting nearly every day to convince workers that they shouldn't unionize, right? And in the meantime, the union is like trying to figure out how to get in touch with people, you know, on their private email addresses or like when they're leaving work or something like that, right? There's just no equivalence in terms of getting the message out. And then, right, like if you've got an unscrupulous employer, right, and I'm not saying every employer is unscrupulous, but if you have one, right, then the remedies that are available, right, are, I would say, just like tremendously insufficient.
Thank you. Kathy McGarry, how does this look from the, you know, from the perspective of a heavily unionized workforce or workplace? And a number of people we've gotten a number of audience questions about the public sector and sort of how the public sector differs from the private sector. So I wonder if you might want to take on some of those questions as well.
Sure. And I would say on the public sector side, particularly because of the work I do, I'm going to see it at maybe a more micro level, but I think that's where it maybe is on the public sector side, because we are organized. So all the things that were just said about the board and the remedies, I think those are fair comments about the board and the challenge of organizing on the private side. On the public side, a couple things. One, I think most folks know that Janice ruling about 10 years ago, maybe, right about the time I came back to the public sector, has changed the public sector union situation in the sense that people can no longer required to pay fair share dues, which what I have seen, and again, just in the little microcosm public sector that I work in, if people aren't paying their fair share dues, then it's only dues members that are paying, which hurts the total economy of the union. In some unions, it doesn't matter at all. You know, there was all this doom and gloom that, oh my gosh, fair share dues are going away, these unions wouldn't have any money. Back at my previous employer, we saw some union folks or some employees decide to go ahead and pay the full dues because they wanted to support the union movement. Some dropped all the way to zero because the law was allowed them to do that. So I didn't see the sort of tidal wave that was expected. What I would say, though, is what I see in people and employees who talk to me, because that's my job, they'll talk to me about whether they should pay dues or not. I'm like, well, that's up to you. But you hear from employees, and I see different sets of employees, some who really see the policy value of labor unions and what's happening legislatively, both at the federal level and the state, and they see that as what the union movement is doing. They might donate money, they might get involved politically. They somehow don't connect that with their job and unionize, being part of the union at their job, maybe even paying dues for their union job. I see that varies quite a bit by what job you're in. So certain sectors, being part of a union is just part of the job. Police, fire, public works, those are people who by and large expect to be in a union, expect to pay dues, are paid a decent amount. So the dues is the amount of the dues isn't as touchy of an issue. And I think they're willing to do both. Be active politically, pay the dues, be part of their union, whether they agree with their local union president or not, it's just what they're gonna do. But there is another group of people that maybe in sectors that aren't normally unionized, maybe a little bit lower wage, that are touchy about, do I actually want to contribute to this group of people, this local union at my workplace where I don't like the president, or where I see them advocating for people I don't agree with? Or, you know, there seems to be a little bit of, I'm for the union concept and the movement. I don't know if I want to be part of this union. And here in the public sector, I don't have to pay for them. They don't have to pay me dues. Last thing I would say, and this may be the answer to a different question in the future, is I think it's been hard for the unions. They are making a little bit less money because of the dues. I have seen unions make actual political changes in terms of how they service their members. Put more money towards organizing, less money towards servicing their members. That's a strategy. But then when you're not servicing your members well, that also has, I've seen that hurt some unions, not all, but I've heard it, seen it hurt some because people don't think they're getting what they pay for, what they're paying for. So they, again, the public sector by and large just stop paying their dues. But you translate that to organizing, it's not necessarily a for sure yes, I would say, even the public sector in those few spots where organizing is still needs to be done.
Thanks. That's really interesting. Just a few clarifications. The National Labor Relations Board is the federal agency that governs collective bargaining for but the private sector, it only covers the private sector. And so public sector workers are governed by state law. And so that varies from state to state. In Minnesota, we have a fairly robust collective bargaining law that governs public sector workers. And fair share dues, most unions are generally required to represent all workers within their bargaining unit, within a workplace, even the ones who don't belong to the union. So fair share dues are a way of paying dues to the union in exchange for part of it's usually lower than the full dues of the union, but it represents the costs of representing non-union members. And the Supreme Court in the Janus decision decided that that was unconstitutional and so struck down fair share dues. President Burnham, would you talk some about some of these questions of barriers to growth?
Sure. I think, there's a number of things. I'm just going to use some of the newer groups that are organizing today as an example. We've talked to a lot of the younger workers at Starbucks and Half Price Books and REI and all the other newer unions. And what tends to happen while they have voted to become union members, then maybe the store has decided they're going to give raises to people who aren't in part of the actions, right? And so they do a conquer and divide kind of thing, which is truly unfair. And so then people think, well, I mean, I get a raise anyway. You know, do I really need a union to get a raise? And the question becomes, how long will that last, right? I mean, how long will the store continue to give raises to people who are not organizing as opposed to organizing? As one of my panelists said, Charlotte, you know, mentioned that they can fire people, you know, because at the moment they have nothing to really keep them from doing that, and they can come up with any kind of reason to do so. So that makes it a little tougher. If you're in fear of losing your job and you need that job, what, you know, it's a way to keep people's voices not heard. I will say, in the state of Minnesota, we were part of legislation this past year that banned captive audience meetings. So that's a great thing here in Minnesota. And there are a few other states here that have that law. So that's helpful. Other barriers. I just think, you know, it is a matter of so many people who are working today, their families were not union members. I mean, I myself only, my mom was a union member. We didn't hear a lot about it. My dad worked in a private club. He was a chef. And so I really knew nothing about the labor movement until I became a teacher. And even then it took me a while to understand, you know, what it was all about. So if you don't come from that background and nobody talks to you about it and it's not taught in school, then you have no sense of what a union does for you. So people think, you know, a lot of people get jobs and they're doing fine and they make good money and they don't understand what is the importance of a union. And as Kathy said, you know, a lot of things that unions do, I will say I'm a teacher here in the state of Minnesota, that's my background. And so we did a lot of organizing and activating for education itself, right? And you talked about Red for Ed. And that was a big deal because people all of a sudden realized, as you said, families were supportive of teachers because their students' learning environment was impacted by what was happening for their educators. I would argue it's the same for paraprofessionals. You know, they're not making nearly enough money. They don't have the training that they should be getting. They work bell to bell. And so a lot of things are lesser for those folks. And people should not be working more than one job to make a living. You know, they are also, I've heard administrators say things like, well, you just took this as a part-time job. Well, that's not necessarily true for a lot of people, you know. So there's a lot of reasons why people have barriers. But I would say the number one is that people just don't know what it's about. You know, and even people who are in unions don't necessarily understand, as Kathy said, what it means to them.
So there's a number of questions that we've been getting from the audience about the sort of broader impact of unions in the public sector. There's been a number of questions of whether unions. So there's one question about I wonder if you could respond to the criticism that teachers are relatively well paid, that schools and that unions have the effect of increasing, so pushing for increased public spending, that isn't always translated into, you know, sort of better test scores and sort of education outcomes. But I think the sort of broader question is sort of what is the sort of the spillover effects of unions? Do we see, you know, workers who are not belonging to unions, are their wages, their benefits, affected by union gains? And I guess that would go, you know, either to the private sector or to the public sector. President Burnham, do you want to
start? I guess I would start immediately by saying, look at UAW. Right after there were some tentative agreements, Toyota raised their salaries for their folks. So did Honda, I believe. I think that there were a number of other auto manufacturers that decided they would give raises to the people. We know that in communities where there is a high union density, it's likely that there's going to be a better pay system and better benefits for people because they need to compete with what union workers are getting.
Mm-hmm. How would you respond to the question about teachers as a former union teacher and teacher union leader? I mean, do unions have a positive impact on the quality of education beyond the sort of the wages and benefits of teachers?
I think that when you have union teachers and unions that are strong in their communities, that everybody gets what they need in a better sense because they're activated to help fight for the community and for the needs of the students. I mean, really, when you talk about bargaining for the better good, which is a big movement in education, that's really what you're talking about, where teachers are fighting for their students first and making sure that classrooms have what they need and that the resources are there so that students get all that they need and that, you know, there are better quality. I mean, who wants to teach in a school that is leaking and you know, has not good systems of water as we've seen in other areas of the country? I think in Minnesota, we're mostly okay. There are smaller communities too, where there's not as big a tax base, where that makes that difficult too. But I think that educators are not only educators in front of your children, they're also activists for the betterment of society. Mm-hmm.
So Professor Garden, you brought up that you also mentioned the bargaining for the common good. This is a relatively new movement, I think largely in the public sector, but taking the idea that unions should bargain not just for the sort of economic concerns of their members, but also for the broader social concerns that are related to their members' work, I think, right? So that teachers would bargain for lower class sizes, nurses would bargain for lower patient loads and things like this that would benefit both the workers, but also their the people they serve. Is that what you were referring to? And you want to talk more about the sort of spillover effects of unionization?
Yeah. So that was exactly what I was referring to. And yeah, I would agree. It's, you know, it's sort of most, you know, you see bargaining for the common good most commonly in the public sector, you know, or in kind of caring professions like nursing that are in sort of both public and private sectors. I completely agree with President Burnham about the kind of like rising tide lifts all boats kind of economic effects of unions bargaining increased contracts. You know, I'm not a labor economist, but if I could like play one on this Zoom webinar for a second, I have seen just a recent paper from some labor economists saying that, you know, although unions do successfully bargain for increased wages and benefits, they often also mean that people stay in their jobs longer and that can have, you know, like productivity benefits or kind of, you know, it benefits in terms of, you know, it's like, doesn't, I don't think it really makes sense to think of teaching in terms of productivity, but, you know, you can improve your skills over time, you know, become a more effective teacher over time. And so, you know, time in the classroom, you know, can have, you know, increasing people's time in the classroom can have those benefits that, you know, redound to students, of course. You know, I would also, you know, I would mention things like, protections for academic freedom, right, type concerns. So, you know, some states have teacher tenure statutes that are separate from union contracts, but union contracts can, you know, do things like build in sort of professional development opportunities. They can provide a way for unions to kind of do some kind of soft peer-to-peer intervention if something is going wrong, right? Without kind of raising the specter of this is disciplinary and therefore, you know, you have to kind of get your back up and be kind of really concerned. So, you know, I think there can be some real benefits to having a union in, you know, in the public sector, right? In the context we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. But I just, if I could add one more point.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about consistency in the classroom as well. I mean, there's nothing worse than when there's turnover from year to year. You know, families get used to their teacher and they like their student to have that same teacher. You know, maybe their next child comes along and they've had a really good relationship and there's trust built there. So if that continues to turn over, that trust kind of goes away. If you can build an ongoing relationship with your educators and your school, your public school, or your charter school, whoever it is, but as long as children have consistent teachers and people in their life, that's very helpful, especially when we talk about poverty. We know there's a lot of inconsistency in the lives of children in many areas. And if that's the one place they go to, where they know it's going to be the same every day and they can trust the people that are with them, that's really important. I think unions help build that consistency as well. Mm-hmm.
So Kathy McGarry, what impact do unions have, you know, if, for example, at the in Hennepin County or at the airport on either the people who use the airport, whether they're the, you know, the people who are flying, the flying public, or the airlines, the other sort of the other people who have a stake in this operation, how are they affected by the unionization of the workforce?
I was actually prepared to answer the earlier question, but I'll start with this one.
Okay.
You know, the most obvious is the services that are provided. So there is the real strike threat for most public workers, not all. And people want continuity of service, whether it's social workers at a county or, you know, people who plow the snow on the airfield. We're really proud of how easy it is to fly out of here in a snowstorm. You need those workers to be there and to be satisfied with their contract, settle those, continuity of the availability of the work is of huge importance to the public. And I was thinking about, in terms of the bargaining for the social good, which is something I think is more in the teacher world, which is not a world I've worked in much. It's also just smart, and I hate to be overly pragmatic, but the money on the public sector side, not so much at the MAC, but at most public sector, it's taxpayer funded at some point. And so if there's going to be a big settlement, there might be an ask for the taxpayers to pay for. And so I think some of it's just good practical appeal to a broader political realm. If you're thinking teacher salaries and you're not sure you want to tax for that, but you do want bigger classrooms, we all know those things go together, but you need to appeal to all the different audiences if you're going to be levying for some of those settlements. So I just think that's a practical matter because we know the spectrum of people interested in supporting public employment varies a lot. There are people who are very supportive of public employees and there are people that are not. And you kind of have to appeal to all sides, I think, to find the money to fund things. The other thing I would say in terms of the spillover effect, every place I've worked, public or private, as a negotiator, we started by preparing by looking at the market. And there's a question in here somewhere I saw about recruitment and retention. Recruitment and retention is important, whether you're union or not union. If you can't get people to come work for you, you have a problem. And if the market is paying a certain rate, and if that's influenced by union rates, we certainly look at what other unions are paying and other jurisdictions are paying. We also look on the non-union side to see what could our folks make somewhere else, whether union or non-union. So the market rates are very important to the management side from a recruitment and retention standpoint. And it should influence the willingness to spend money at the table, again, somewhat buffered in the public sector by the availability of funds. And you could also say choices made by jurisdictions about how they're going to spend the taxes that they can collect. I think there's absolutely a spillover effect of all of our decisions. We all spill over. All the compensation decisions in the market, union or non-union, spill over to the rest of the market for sure, especially in a tight labor market.
Yeah, thank you. That's really useful. I want to get to some of the ways in which talk about the future a little bit. Before I do that, there are a number of questions about the political positions that unions take. So one question was, why don't unions support conservative candidates? And does that sort of leave out the voices of conservative union members? Another is that, do unions get themselves into trouble when they speak out? So one of the example in the question is on questions, the conflict in the Middle East, for example. How do unions sort of negotiate being these political organizations and yet trying to, you know, encompass a much broader and often, you know, ideologically or politically diverse membership? Professor Burnham, or I'm sorry, President Burnham, do you want to take that on?
Yeah, those are tough things, right? I mean, I think the our Minnesota AFL-CIO, that was part of the problem, right? When George Floyd was murdered, and our Minnesota AFL-CIO made a statement, and some affiliates took issue with it, and they walked away from the table. And so those are very hard things, and it's not just the AFL-CIO as a whole, it is all the individual unions too. Leadership has to think really long and hard before they make a statement, because their members are everywhere, right? I mean, whether we're talking about gun control, or we're talking about women's rights, or we're talking about LGBTQ plus, or any of that, their members sit all over that table, you know, from one end of the spectrum to the other. So those are long, hard conversations, and leadership makes choices as to whether they really want to stand up for an issue or not. We try to be bipartisan, and I know many, many times get accused, as you said, of not supporting conservative candidates. Now, if that candidate has the values that support the work of the union, whatever union that may be, there's a likelihood they might, you know, get an endorsement. Now, overall, I would say most of the time it looks like no. That's, you know, you're right that they usually, conservatives don't get supported. But when we think about the values that different unions have, that's really where that all lays in. So I can't really give you a solid answer on that, because again, it's one of those things where you've got to be thinking about what everybody in your room is thinking about, and that your membership comes from all over, you know. And in Minnesota, teachers live from obviously the southernmost tip to the northernmost tip, and they have a variety of political beliefs and religious beliefs, and they can get you into some sticky wickets sometimes, I'll say.
Yeah, thank you. So I want to sort of move into asking about and talking about some of the ways in which the situation might be improved, particularly in terms of that contradiction that we began with. I mean, how might we see a closer alignment between what people seem to want and the reality of union representation? And Kathy McGarry, I wanted to start with you, particularly because we had a number of questions that came in about sort of human resources and the way that plays into some of these questions. So one of the questions was just sort of simply, whatever happened to labor management collaboration? I suspect that you'll argue it hasn't gone away, but I wonder if you could talk about that role. And then there another question that was, what role is the schooling of students in the discipline of human resources and industrial relations playing in manipulating the aspirations or militancy of unions and union activity?
I'm going to start with the schooling first and maybe take a different place than you were going to. And I'm going to say this for both sides, management and union, so I don't offend anyone, or maybe offend both sides equally. We are short of talent on both the management and the union side at the sort of negotiating, servicing contracts, just the world of labor relations. You know, when I went through graduate school 100 years ago, I was one of the few that wanted to do labor relations. Most people wanted to do corporate HR. I speak the U quite a bit, and there are students that have a heart for the union movement, and so could go work for unions, not just go on the company side like I did. But I don't know that they're having a good experience always when they go to work for unions. I don't know if unions, and I don't know enough to say this, but I just don't know if unions are a good employer or seen as a good option. And I don't know if that's a lack of unions sort of putting themselves out there, a lack of students being educated and encouraged to look at the union movement as a place to work. I will say, you know, certainly I didn't feel tremendously encouraged to pursue labor relations when I was at school, just because there's fewer jobs, but there are jobs. I have a job open right now. If you know anybody, you know, there, it is getting harder and harder to find people though. You know, all the people I grew up kind of under respecting on both sides have retired. There's not as many people filling in. So I think that's an education issue in general. You know, and most human resources people are going to end up with some labor relations experience at some point, but there's just very few, especially when you get to the bargaining table. There's just not as much experience on either side, and it is harder to get things done, which I think makes it harder for unions to seem successful. It's just harder to work when neither side is very experienced and when fewer people are going into it. When you talk about labor management collaboration, you know, public sector there, it's still here, I would say. There are still labor management committees. There's still an ethos of that. It's, again, the unions have been here a long time. These are longstanding relationships generally. I would say some of the new tactics of this sort of younger, not always younger workers has hit some jurisdictions hard. You know, kind of the traditional way that unions would approach public sector management, there was very long-term relationships and it was very peaceful. And I think as the more, a little bit more in your face, a little bit more activist sort of approach has come in, not all jurisdictions have adjusted well to that. I think it's just new and it looks different in the labor management context. It's not always pleasant. And some folks have left the field because of that. Others have maybe over-responded in a negative way to that, but I think we're evolving, even in the public sector side, to sort of new union members are also new employees, and people have new expectations of their workplace now. And I think it makes the labor management meetings different, although we still have them. I would say they're more challenging than they used to be, not necessarily worse, but more challenging, especially with the level of newness on both sides of the table and the lack of maybe education about how it sort of what the basic rules of the road are. And then there's less willingness to follow the basic rules of the road as well, because of sort of an ethos that maybe those rules aren't getting us where we need to go.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I appreciate your plug for students that going into labor relations, for all the undergraduates who are on this, call. Professor Garden, do you want to take up some of the questions about how this situation might be improved?
I guess one thing I'd say is when I started, remember when I first started teaching, one of my new colleagues said to me, why do you write about unions? I heard unions are disappearing. I don't think anyone would say that now, right? Like, I think there has been this real shift in terms of how, you know, students I talk to think about going into the labor movement. So whereas when, you know, I think when I was a law student, if you were in the early 2000s, if you were a kind of like public interest minded student, like you wouldn't really think about going to a union or working for labor because of the kind of like male, pale and stale, like, reputation. But I think that has really changed and that people now, like public interest minded law students and undergrads I talk to, see union organizing, labor law, right, as being a really compelling thing to do. So, that's, maybe that's a pipeline, right? That's like a few years out from fruition, but it makes me really optimistic about the future.
President Burnham?
Sure, I want to go back to the labor management piece. I came out of a strong labor management system when I was in Duluth as a teacher. That was a big part of what we did between our district and our union and educators and everybody. And I think, Kathy, I think you're right. I think what I saw as people changed, not everybody had the same understanding about what it was to be sitting at the table and what were the common goals and what were we actually trying to do. In my mind, and I used to ask for this, that we have a reset every fall because there are new people coming to the table. And if they don't know the process and don't know the reason for doing it, then that changes things. And you're right, especially today with lots of newer, younger folks coming to the table who necessarily, as I said before, don't even know what a union stands for or what it means to you as an individual. Until you have some sense of training or some kind of training that gets everybody to the same spot to begin with, it makes it that much more difficult. And it's a conversation we have, and I have with people all the time about if you're going to put that in play, it's a great process if it works well. I will say that 10 times over. But if something changes and not everybody is coming to the table with the same understanding of how we're going to work together and how the voices are shared, then that throws a kink into the whole system. So I it's a great process. I think that every year, as your team changes, there needs to be a reboot or a retraining. And so everybody comes with the same understanding of what you're trying to do.
Thank you. Professor Garden, you use the phrase male, pale, and stale. And I wanted to just, I want to pick up on that. So I think there is a public perception, and in part that's rooted in an actual history of the union movement being dominated by men and dominated by white men in particular. I thought, I think it's interesting that we have this panel that is all women. I think that in some ways reflects a change, certainly in the longer history of thinking about both the study of unions and human relations and the union movement itself. And I wonder, just in closing, we have a few minutes. I wonder if some of you, if you wanted to talk about that, about those changes in the demographic shifts within the union movement. So Professor Garden, do you want to begin with that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is like a huge question that we could probably spend, a whole another hour on.
In the last 3 minutes.
Right. I mean, I guess, so one thing I'd say is just this, right? Like, there are almost the same number of public sector and private sector unionized workers in America, which is remarkable because the private sector is just vastly bigger than the public sector. And so the most unionized professions are, on one hand, education, and on the other hand, kind of like public safety, law enforcement, fire. And so, education dominated by women, public safety dominated by men. It's an interesting, sort of contrast when you think about the kind of like larger, what that means for kind of the larger union movement. The other thing I'll say is that, unions are, in terms of like wage gains, unions are hugely beneficial in terms of erasing racial wage gaps, because students sort of imagine why, right? Like, because a contract tends to set criteria for pay and raises, et cetera, based on objective criteria such as seniority, right? So there's a huge sort of benefit and a huge racial justice benefit from unionization.
Thanks, Kathy McGarry. And you don't have to address this question. If there's anything you want to just leave us with, that would be great.
Stop off mute. It's interesting, having been a female in this field my whole career, I thought it was more of an impediment than it has been. Certainly, I would agree that you have sort of the male unions, and then, because I've been in the public sector a lot, and I was, the private side, I was in department store retail, there are a lot of women in those unions. Department store retail is largely female, counties and cities. Somebody mentioned in one of the questions, the office workers in most public jurisdictions, what you think of as white collar, most of them are also in unions, which is not something you see as much in a private company. So I think it has been more beneficial than not to be able to work in both sort of the female and the male dominated unions. I don't know that it's been a hindrance. I would say I would say that when I've sat across the table, both public and private sector, there were often women on the other side, not always, but there are women in the movement, even in the sort of historical fields. I think as you look at the new sectors, a lot of the new sectors that are trying to be organized skew a little bit female, and maybe the organizing approaches need to be different. It's hard to know if it's female or just skew younger. I actually think the younger might be the bigger difference than the female part, maybe the organizing.
Okay. President Burnham, just the final word.
Sure. Well, I'll just say, I went to my first national AFL-CIO convention a year ago, and I can tell you the demographics had definitely shifted in that room. 52% were women and people of color. So if you think about the history of unions being mostly dominated by white males, that's changed, right? And I can tell you here in the state of Minnesota, across all sectors, including the trades, there is a big push to bring in people of color and women as well. And everybody's working hard at that. And so, yeah, the faces look different. The names are different. The ages are different. And it's a good thing for the labor movement to keep it moving and going to continue to be strong. And I think I'll go back to who holds the wealth in the country. That's a fight that we're all willing to take on. And, you know, because it is about the working people. They're the ones who make things happen. So appreciate the conversation today. And thank you for having me here.
Well, thank you to Bernie Burnham, Charlotte Garden, and Kathy McGarry for a great conversation. And thanks to all of you who joined us online. Have a good afternoon.